This is an interview with William Dove at the top of McArdle Laboratory. The date is August 16th, 2013. I'm Molly Loss. So, Dr. Dove, I know your graduate training was in physical chemistry at Caltech in the early 1960s. So how did you become interested in genetics?
Well, let me just say at the outset that this is a history as seen in August of 2013. And I recognize that any history is really a fiction. We put together a story that makes sense to us right now, but it didn't actually happen that way. And a famous man named Peter Medawar, a Brit named Peter Medawar, said that almost every scientific publication is also a fiction. We make up a story to make it seem sensible that we planned it this way and it turned out this way. So what I'm going to say looks as though I planned it that way. But I will now answer your question. It isn't that I started out in physical chemistry hoping to end up doing what I'm now doing today. A lot of it is opportunistic. And the opportunities that I'll talk about in my next hour with you had a lot to do with the McArdle community and the opportunities that it presented for me to go through this evolution. So I'll now answer your question. I was interested in physical chemistry and chemistry altogether since high school. I did my undergraduate work in chemistry. I loved to work in the chemistry lab, loved to make compounds. I entered graduate school at Caltech, which is, after being a liberal arts undergraduate, I really learned how to do research at Caltech. And there the whole culture is one of doing research, breaking the boundary between what we know and what we need to know. Asking questions rather than just taking answers from textbooks. And so the questions that really intrigued me there were the behavior of molecules, and studying it more deeply, studying quantum mechanics in terms of understanding molecular orbital theory, predicting how different molecules would behave. So this deepened my fascination with chemistry. Now, Caltech is a small but really excellent research university where a number of different fields of endeavor are investigated. And at the time that I was a graduate student, there was a leading scholar named Max Delbruck, who'd been trained in physics and had become interested in biology, and who gathered around him people from many different backgrounds to investigate problems in biology. And so I was able to, while doing my chemistry PhD, to do experiments in the Delbruck laboratory. So I was a chemistry PhD, but I could do some of my work in a biology department there. So while studying physical chemistry, I was exposed to the issues in biology, especially the genetic issues. And I was primed then to learn how to really analyze biological problems. So it was then as a postdoctoral fellow that I learned how to use genetics to analyze biological problems. So though I had heard a lot about genetics while working in the Delbruck lab, I didn't learn how to use it. The difference between chemistry as I describe it, where you make things out of earth, air, fire, and water, or whatever elements you believe in at the day, on the day. Make things out of elements, and you feel really good if you made a complicated molecule from scratch. Mm-hmm. So it's synthesis. It's what I call bottom-up understanding of the molecule or the ensemble of molecules involved in any interesting process, bottom-up. By contrast, the kind of genetics that I learned as a postdoctoral fellow is top-down, where you take a working biological system that is growing and you ask what mutations interfere in that process. So you subtract one element at a time. And if you're doing a thorough genetic analysis, you ask, what of all of the genes in the organism, which ones are specially involved in that process? So in my case, DNA replication of a simple virus. So that is top down. And do these two approaches meet? Do they finally encounter the same molecule that you found in doing chemistry was part of building a replication system, if you were successful to build it from scratch? No, not very many people have been successful, but that is a hope that biochemists have. Does it meet the same molecules that genetics finds when you subtract each essential element by mutation, and you find that when you mutate a gene, you then learn what molecule does that gene code for? So the great bridge that connects those of us who believe in molecules with those of us who use genetics, the great bridge is the mutated gene. When a gene is mutated, you can find out by sequencing what does that whole gene code for, what protein, or maybe indirectly through a polysaccharide made by a protein, but primarily a protein. What protein does it code for? And how did that protein get changed when you interrupted the system? And then when you do chemistry or biochemistry, you find that the same protein is an essential part of the system that you put together from scratch that replicates in a test tube. And this kind of approach has been successful. Most of the cases have depended on people who, biochemists, who also used genetics, because it's given them the confidence that a molecule that they purified was actually part of the real system rather than part of something else, by finding that that molecule is mutated in when the organism fails to replicate.
So anyway,
that's the path by along which I followed, and I, to go back to my initial statement, it had a lot of opportunistic steps. How come that at Caltech I could actually, while doing a PhD in chemistry, work in a lab that was doing biology?
Mm. Did you also work with Linus Pauling at Caltech?
With who?
With Linus Pauling.
Well, I did. So he was what the, to use a French phrase, the amanus gris of the chemistry department. He was so famous, he'd won two Nobel Prizes, one in peace and one in chemistry. He was not spending much time on the faculty. He was born in 1902, I believe, so he was approaching 60 when I finished my PhD. But he'd brought, because of his fame, he'd brought a group of undergraduates from England to work on a pet problem of his, but he didn't have a person to supervise them in the lab. And I had just finished my PhD. I certainly could supervise these undergraduates. And So I worked on a project, and each week I would talk with Pauling about the way the project was going. It was a project on which we worked for a whole summer, and I could see the kinds of the great intuitive brilliance that that Pauling always brought to science, and his command over chemistry and his distance from hands-on experimental work as he became more involved in public affairs and other things than chemistry. But the problem on which I worked with these undergraduates had to do with the action of general anesthetics that seemed to be rather inert molecules that didn't have special affinity for particular enzymes. And he was interested in the idea that they structured water, formed particular structures of water around the general anesthetic and would thereby change the nervous system of an individual. So he was interested in studying those so-called clathrate complexes of molecules like xenon that has, it's an inert gas, it has no ability to bind to anything significant except just out of its mass. So he was interested in those problems, which for me took me back to my basic interest in molecules and how they act and really understanding their structure. Mm-hmm. It was a biological problem, but it didn't have the genetics that then I was able to pursue once I learned how to use it. And I think still doesn't. I don't know that there's any system whereby one can understand how general anesthetics operate.
So you've also, I think, written elsewhere that regulation of growth is an overarching theme in your career. So what led you to be interested in that question?
Right, so as a postdoctoral fellow, I was greatly influenced by the person who became my mentor. I originally was assigned to Francis Crick, and at the time that I arrived in MRC Cambridge, he was consumed in trying to fill in the gaps in understanding the genetic code. And there were a number of biochemical approaches to that that had become feasible just in 1961, 1962, at the time that I arrived. And he wanted to employ anyone available in carrying out these biochemical binding experiments to establish for what amino acid did a particular triplet code for. So these were well-defined experiments, and they did not excite me. His colleague, Sidney Brenner, who had been really a key partner in the work that Crick did on the genetic code, particularly a famous frameshift experiment that showed that the genetic code was a triplet code. Brenner really understood the genetics that led to that great experiment. Brenner still, he born in 1927, still a very creative person who really starts his thinking with genetics. Became interested in the control of replication during that year of 1963 and published a paper with Francois Jacob. I talked about this in the MRC essay that I gave to you. Published a paper with Francois Jacob, who, again, a Frenchman whose thinking pattern started with genetics also. It was called the replicon model for DNA replication. And this was an intriguing model and one that I wanted to test. And the tests were not straightforward. It wasn't easy to figure out how to test it. But here another opportunity came along. While at Caltech, I had worked on phage lambda, which is a bacterial virus. And it has a special aspect to its life cycle. It can live passively while integrated into the host genome. It doesn't have to do any of its own work except to keep itself passive so it doesn't go off and kill the host. It just sits there passively, keeping itself quiet, and is replicated by the host. So if you were to inactivate any of its replication genes, it doesn't matter. It's still there. But then when you remove this, its system by which it keeps itself quiet, so that now it has to grow, it doesn't, because it can't if it's mutated. And so I worked out ways to select for mutant bacterial viruses, lambda, that could be maintained as a provirus, but couldn't then go into the lytic phase. Just as an anecdote, which really has to do with phase two, but this issue about latency versus active growth is rampant throughout all of current McArdle research. Those who work on Epstein-Barr virus, Shannon Kenny, Bill Sugden, they're very interested in that question of latency versus lytic growth of Epstein-Barr virus. In our own laboratory, very interested in the stages of early neoplasia, early cancer in the colon that are often passive, latent, sometimes even spontaneously regressing, whereas in other cases they start to grow and continue to grow and progress and kill the host. But more than half the time an early tumor, in fact, becomes latent. So this is just a side anecdote, but this is an issue that I studied carefully in phage lambda, where the methods were available in the mid-60s. Methods were available. Methods that are now available for complicated biological problems were available for that then. So there I'm pointing out the importance impact of Sidney Brenner, my postdoc mentor, and still a stimulating colleague, but also the impact of Francois Jacob, who I knew only at a distance while a postdoc, but in whose lab I later worked along with Alexander when he turned his attention to mammalian differentiation. And there in his lab I could learn, well, along with Alexandra, all of the methods that we now use a decade and a half later as methods became available.
When did you work in Jacob's lab?
As a Guggenheim fellow in 1975 to 76. And it was at a transition time when our children were now in primary school, had all gotten into primary school by that time. And so we were able to go to work in France. They were able to go to French school. Alexander was able to go back into research because she had basically wanted to be home while our kids were in preschool. So she was able to go back into research, and so the two of us apprenticed ourselves to the group of senior investigators who Jacob had gathered around him, because he, by that time, was very famous in France and had a very large laboratory with senior people to whom who were doing the experiments and to whom we could apprentice ourselves and learn how to do those experiments. But to go back to your question, studying how a virus replicates or doesn't replicate came out of my postdoctoral learning how to use genetics to tease apart a complicated system. So that was a time, Molly, when the biochemists, Arthur Kornberg was the leader, were trying to build systems for DNA replication for the host, E. coli, out of purified enzymes. And on my way to joining the faculty in McArdle, while my lab was being finished, the biochemistry department at Stanford gave me space to work after I'd accepted a position here, but my lab was not ready to work in. And I became quite familiar with Arthur Kornberg's really wonderful biochemistry and science and his and the kind of culture that he developed and then persists in Stanford biochemistry department. And I know that by then I was committed to genetic analysis, and that each time he would talk about the purified Kornberg polymerase, I would ask, perhaps was considered rude to ask, well, do you know that it's involved in DNA replication? And a man, John Cairns, at Cold Spring Harbor, challenged Kornberg in the same way by explicitly isolating mutants in the Kornberg polymerase and showing that it had no effect on the ability of E. coli to replicate its DNA. So people in Jacob's lab had isolated mutants of E. coli that failed to replicate. There they had, these mutants had to be isolated as thermosensitive alleles, because replication is necessary. The only way you can propagate it is if the mutant is okay at one temperature and bad at another. So they had a large series of DNA replication defectives that were, that had a temperature-sensitive property. And ironically, 2 years after I finished and came to join the faculty in McArdle, Arthur Kornberg published a paper showing that one of these genes, not the one for his polymerase, but one for another DNA polymerase that he had put aside, another DNA polymerase was mutated in one of these bona fide replication temperature-sensitive strains of E. coli. And he did it by violating the principle of purifying any enzyme. He did it by taking extracts from the mutant strain, not completely purifying them, but working with a rather crude extract that still had a number of other molecules still present, and showing that that crude extract couldn't show any replication at the high temperature when the mutant was inactive. Could replicate at the low temperature, and asked, okay, at the high temperature, what do you have to add to make it replicate? And it was this other DNA polymerase called Pol III, different from the Kornberg Pol I, that could rescue. So he did eventually combine his great chemistry with this kind of genetics willing to work with crude systems in order to carry out this proof. And it's an example that the approach of the chemist going from purified substances, trying to put it all together, seldom works. You have to know a lot. And to know a lot, most of it comes from doing all the genetics first and finding out what are the molecules that are important and putting the known molecules together. Well, so our work with replication in lambda then identified what does lambda provide in order to allow it to replicate. And much of the molecular detail then came from work, some of it from Fred Blattner here in Geneva, who had been a postdoc with Veslaw Szabolski, but then took a faculty position in genetics here. But he was one of the first to make DNA synthesis sequencing feasible for small genomes, lambda, E. coli, what now works for the human genome. Very quickly, he made work for E. coli and lambda back then in the early 70s. And so a good deal of our molecular information came by collaboration with Fred Blattner. And so I'll take a small pause. Everything I'm talking about, so just as a footnote here, everything I'm talking about sounds as though it's stuff that I did. And with Lambda, I had a hands-on connection with a good deal of what went on, but not everything. And everything I'll talk about even then, but certainly beyond, has involved the terrific people who've been in my lab. And when we talk about community in our next phase, I'm wanting to mention the McArdle community and how it seems to function and how it might continue to function as we're transported over to Wimmer in our next incarnation. But so in our work with Fred Blattner, my graduate students were key in making that collaboration work. I talked about a transition in terms of methods. So this exemplifies this opportunistic, who knew that I could do serious work on anything more complicated than a simple virus when I joined the faculty. And Harold Rush hired me knowing that I was going to work on a simple virus. He was interested in Howard Temin's work on a tumor virus, and indeed some of what we did interacted with what Howard was doing. And the little essay I sent to you tells you more about that interaction that went on very actively during the time that Howard was alive until 1993. But phage lambda, DNA virus, its logic, its detailed logic is not the same as that of a RNA tumor virus. Many details, difference in detail. Some of the sort of overriding questions were similar, but some of the methods were certainly shared. But who knew that I could work on anything more complicated than a simple bacterial virus for which the methods were available to a person who'd been trained in chemistry?
So with that in mind, you began to work on the slime mold culture, right? So how did you make that shift?
Right. So in the by the 1970s, I talked about DNA sequencing becoming feasible, our work with Fred Blattner, and some of this detailed analysis of genomes in more complicated creatures, such as yeast, microbial eukaryotes, such as Dictyostelium, and in the case of Fusarium, a microbe whose biology was quite fascinating in regard to growth. It became feasible to analyze the genome of these more complicated organisms. So Drosophila, of course, was sort of a mainstream genetic organism whose DNA sequence work took off in the 70s. Fusarium's genome still has not been sequenced because of some idiosyncrasies of its structure, a number of repeat sequences that have prevented easy assembly of its genome, but still targeted sequencing became feasible. And so its biology then, knowing we could do some of the molecular analysis, its biology was dominating. It's an organism that shows eukaryotic style replication. It has eukaryotic nuclei, and it presents the mitotic cycle in a very amplified way. One of the stages, the ways in which it proliferates, is a syncytium that can be literally the size of a pizza, growing onto fine medium. And Harold Rush, in his lab, had perfected the ways to grow Fusarium. And by that time, he was no longer active at supervising research. But together with my first graduate student, Finn Haugli, we began to work on Fusarium because of its synchronous replication cycle. So at the size of a pizza here, this actively streaming cytoplasm, a flat single cell with perhaps 10 to the ninth nuclei going through division at the same time, it amplified what's going on in the mitotic cycle, giving many copies of whatever molecular events were happening. And so we began to study this mitotic cycle. And to do some genetics, one can't do genetics on such a multicellular stage, but the organism goes through meiosis and makes a cellular stage called the myxamoeba. And the cellular stage has just one copy of its genome per cell. And so if there's a mutation in that copy, then it will affect the phenotype of that cell or of the syncytium into which it can convert. So we were able to find mutations in the microtubular system that's a really key part of the mitotic apparatus. We were able to find the mutations by working with the cellular form, but then converting mutant organ cellular stage into mutant syncytial phase and studying what goes on. And we were able, in particular with three very able people, Tim Berland, who became an assistant scientist in our lab, Tim Schadl, a graduate student in molecular biology, and Keith Gull, a sabbatical visitor from England. Together with those three, we were able to study molecular processes that happen during the mitotic cycle and how the microtubular system shows very dramatic regulation in anticipation of the mitosis, and then when it's complete, how it then inactivates itself. So this feed forward, feedback, sort of yin and yang to any kind of cycle became very apparent, became analyzed in molecular detail. And we knew what molecules were participating in because they carried mutations that affected the molecule, and the mutations that we selected as mixed amoebae that were resistant to certain anti-microtubule drugs, drugs that are used in cancer therapy. So we were able to study a eukaryotic cell cycle in some detail by combining the cell biology that Harold Rush had created and the genetics that we really brought into the system. Physarum had very little genetics until we got to work on it over the mid-70s to 80s.
How does your work on Physarum relate to cancer research?
Well, so a simple-minded view of cancer is that it's uncontrolled replication. That's sort of a simple view. Kind of depends, to make it more sophisticated, what do you mean by uncontrolled? Uncontrolled in respect to what? But anyway, uncontrolled replication, and that if one can make cancers differentiate, many differentiated cells are post-mitotic, stop replicating. So this is a simple-minded view of cancer and how to prevent cancer. So to really begin to understand that at a basic level, we wanted to understand how eukaryotic cells replicate. And we studied one aspect of it, not the DNA polymerase, but the mitotic apparatus. I'll now make further side comment, or sort of a transposition comment, to respond to your question. I think in the second installment of this discussion that we have next week, I'll use a metaphor called seed and soil. And a person doing research, he's got to have ideas, and generally speaking, your ideas aren't formed by committee. They come out of individual people. But they don't mature unless there's a soil in which they can grow and flourish. Sometimes that soil is a colleague who will discuss the idea and refine it and say where it's wrong, where it's right. Sometimes the seed germinates when the whole community is thinking about a certain area. In this case, McArdle thinks about cancer. And so what we were doing with Lambda and with Physarum was in a culture that was thinking a lot about cancer. But I can say that even back into the 60s when I was beginning, there was pressure put on me by senior faculty. Do your genetics on mammalian cells. Well, I knew that the genetics on mammalian cells was not rational, that one selected for variants in cells whose ploidy was not controlled, and so you never knew how many copies of any one gene were present. So in a genetic system where you can't control the ploidy, any genetics that you do, first of all, cannot be mapped. Secondly, has a large ascertainment bias. And so I felt I could learn more in more controlled genetic systems, Lambda and then Physarum. Things came along, however, in the late 70s. And as a result of the time that we spent working with Jacob at the Pasteur Institute, I recognized that what was needed to make mammalian genetics move forward was efficient mutagenesis of the germline. Because the germline is a controlled haploid state where every gene is there in only one copy. And if it's mutated, then it affects the whole individual who's born from that fertilization. And this is a little bit about phase two, but in McArdle, Charlie Heidelberger had a wonderful visiting faculty member named Peter Brooks, with whom I had a lot in common, family-wise, tennis-wise. We had a lot of discussions about different carcinogens and how they act. And so it became clear to me in the late 70s that there was a certain class of carcinogens that had a good chance of being effective mutagens in the germline, because they would move throughout the whole animal, in contrast to many other carcinogens that were primarily activated within the liver by metabolism within the liver, something a key that the Millers were leaders in the secondary metabolism of carcinogens. But the nitrosamids were molecules that would act as mutagens without any metabolic activation. And so when Jim Miller put in a postdoc, a facility grant proposal in the around 78, we had a project involving nitrosamids to see if they would act as mutagens. At that same interval, the large mutagenesis facility in Oak Ridge, Bill Russell, studied the same class of molecules and published in 1979 that one of these, ethylnitrosourea, one of these nitrosamids was active, and he had a huge mouse facility by which he could prove it. And so we were immediately knew that we could really approach mammalian biology, including cancer in mammals, with genetic methods that for us were rational. And so, again, opportunity knocks. We knew that Alexander wanted to get into serious research at that stage. We were back from apprenticing ourselves, and to make a mutagenesis program work, I mean, a lot of this is in the MRC thing that I gave you, to make mutagenesis work, it takes what we call calendar time, because the progress of an experiment is staged by the life cycle of the animal. You can't make mice produce progeny in a day. You have to wait. But you have to see your animals each day. And so while our kids were in school, if a child was sick, she wouldn't come into the lab during the day. She'd come in at night when I went home. She'd see her animals every day. And yet, because of our shared background in molecular genetics, she knew exactly what had to be accomplished. And because we'd raised three children, she had the level of patience that you need to do this, and the calendar time needed, as opposed to what we call clock time, which means that you've got a 10-hour day to do a intricate experiment, can't predict exactly when it's going to finish. She didn't have clock time. She had calendar time. That worked. So it gave us the opportunity to begin to develop mutations in the mouse that were effective in differentiation. And as a byproduct to that came the first mouse mutant that in the germline that developed intestinal cancer. So this was in the mid-80s, and it again rested on several bits of opportunity. If you like, in 1965 I would have decided this is where I'm going to work, but I didn't know that I could. I had to follow the opportunities that came along out of methods and people. So again, don't forget the people. made all of this happen.
So, to sort of talk a little more about the min-maps, which is what I assume you're referring to, so what are some of the more applications of this research tool?
Well, with the min-mouse, we've been able to study, first of all, the system of genes in the mouse genome that can adopt forms, either mutant forms or so-called polymorphisms that differ between one strain and another. What genes, aside from the one, the so-called gatekeeper gene, what other genes affect the process? And how do they affect it? What cells? Is it the tumor cell itself or some of the associated cells in the tumor microenvironment? So we've been able to study compensation for this predisposition. So this is a different kind of cancer genetics than what one tends to read about or what's most popular. What you read about, somebody has found a gene for one kind of cancer. What it really means is they have found a gene in which there's an allelic form that tips the balance. But it doesn't mean that's the only gene involved. It just means that's the sort of Achilles heel in the system. And maybe there are several genes that are each equally poised to tip the balance. But once the balance is tipped, then you can find out what other genes change the flux through the system, the way in which the tumor grows and progresses, slows it down. So the first such modifier we know to be expressed from a differentiated cell type within the intestine called the Paneth cell, and it makes a secreted molecule that slows down the growth rate of tumors quite significantly, quite measurably. Even one copy of that slows it down, two copies slows it down even more. You put that together with other modifying loci, other places in the genome, you can get a situation where the animal is totally predisposed but doesn't develop any tumors at all. They can't grow. So this is the use of mouse genetics to discover naturally protective alleles or molecules. Whenever I say allele, then because of the bridge I was talking about at the beginning, that can become a molecule. You can find out what molecule, what form of the molecule protects. So we know this is a great opportunity. Other key aspects of early intestinal cancer have been discovered by using the min-mouse in our lab. It's generally stated that cancer is a clonal process, and indeed, if you take cells from a cancer, like you take HeLa cells, you can culture them, and finally you can clone them out in culture, and they can grow from a single cell with pretty high efficiency. It can become clonal. But when it starts, we found that very often there's a clonal cooperation between different lineages that one can show participate in the early stages of a tumor. So the fact that there's an involvement of clonal cooperation suggests ways that one might interfere with the earliest stages. Some of our current work with the min-mouse asks whether animals carrying these early stages of tumor make particular proteins in their serum that you can use to detect, here's an animal with a tumor, there's an animal without a tumor. And when I sort of finish what I have to say about our trajectory towards studying cancer, I want to say a bit about that. Importance of early detection compared to everything else that one can do right now. So with the min-mouse in our own lab, we've been able to do quite a bit. But we also know that this cancer is, am I nearly done? What time is it? 1:45? Good. So, you know, we can continue this. I'll just finish one. Two short messages. One, any one cancer is more than any one lab. So as soon as Min was shown what it was, and we worked with Johns Hopkins to do the molecular cloning of the mutated gene and to show what molecule was changed, as soon as it was known what it was, we persuaded the Jackson Lab to make it available around the world to researchers with no restrictions, that they had to prevent them from breeding, they couldn't propagate them against various other backgrounds and so on, totally unrestricted. And Jackson Lab charged royalties for commercial outfits that wanted to use the Min mouse. This is 1993, and in what, the 20 years since, there have been many hundreds of publications using the Min mouse. And we've learned from all of these, because the Jackson Lab maintains them on a genetically fixed background, so we don't have to wonder, did they use the wrong background? So we've learned a lot, but so have others learned a lot. And there's a very strong contrast, because the very same time, in around 1990, that the Min mouse was published, so was the Onco mouse from Harvard. And it was then licensed by Harvard to DuPont, and DuPont put very strong restrictions on the use of the Onco mouse, and people couldn't breed it at will. So if you look between 1990 and 2013, the number of publications on the Min mouse is many hundreds. The number of publications on the Onco mouse is 10 or 20. And people haven't learned much from the Onco mouse because of that. So we've been lucky by working with Worf at this university. So this comes in the community business, the community at Wisconsin, and Worf in particular. So Worf has been supportive of making strains available worldwide. Whenever there's a commercial use, there's a royalty, but research can go on unimpeded. So the second message I just wanted to end with, and we can return to that, but that people are, you know, cancer is a huge endeavor around the world, and certainly in the U.S., and lots of detail about how cancer forms and the different oncogenes and suppressor genes, and lots of detailed information. And right now, the major therapeutic for cancer is only palliative, and that, of all things, is 5-fluorouracil, discovered here by Charlie Heidelberger back in the late 50s. 5-fluorouracil is all, and it's only palliative. It's not a complete cure of advanced colon cancer. What one must believe is, if there are ways to detect colon cancer when it's early and can be taken out surgically, that would be the best way to address this as a public health problem. So we do want to help. If what we do can contribute to that, we would really feel it's proper. So we're doing some work like that.
Great, thank you very much.